Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for all of you today. Katie Martin will be my guest. She's the executive director of the Food Share Institute for Hunger Research and Solutions, and also the author of a great new book, Reinventing Food Banks and Pantries. And she'll be coming on in just a little bit to talk about the work she's doing with food pantries and her research at the root causes of hunger in this country. And so I'm excited to have her on. But first, as always, before she comes on, I want to share with you some things going on in around the news, some ways you can take action, and of course, share my weekly recipe with all of you. First, I wanted to share with all of you, I wrote about it this week in my newsletter, that over the last year since COVID and my job as the farm to school coordinator at Glen Cove Public School came to a screeching halt. And my husband, all his jobs kind of got canceled. We had a moment to kind of reinvent ourselves and figure out the direction we wanted to go. And I came back into working with him in the studio, which is kind of a return to my roots. I actually went to art school and food became my medium of art for so many years. And it still is. I mean, I totally love everything about food. The way it looks, the way it tastes, the way it smells, the way it brings people together, the way it addresses environmental issues, hunger issues, health issues. I mean, it's got it all. So it is my passion. But I do love art and creating. And his business as an architectural metal and glass artist has been really wonderful and supported us all these years and allowed me to do my passion. And so now I'm back in the office helping his business stay afloat. And for those of you who are curious, you can check out our website at jaroff.com, just our last name.com. But I've been working with him and, you know, I just was, you know, reflecting on my gratitude of being able to go with the flow and be here now. Those are like spiritual mantras that I learned back in my teens when I first started getting into yoga and meditation. And they have been my mantras throughout my life, you know, and John Lennon's quote, life is what happens while you make busy making other plans, is also a real beauty. So put all those together and I'm just going with the flow. I can't let go of this radio show because I love it so much. And it also keeps my hand involved with my other passions. So anyway, I just wanted to share that with all of you who have been such supporters over these 11 years, I believe, I've been doing the radio show. So anyway, it's just wonderful. Ways you can take action. This week, I wrote about the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, their proposal to put huge storm surge barriers throughout the Hudson River to protect us from sea level rise. And there's a lot of downsides to that need to really be looked at. You know, an environmental impact statement definitely needs to be researched, how it's going to affect the living ecosystem that lives in and around the river needs to be really looked at, and also how it's going to affect the tides. And those grassroots organizations that are involved with this don't feel like they've done enough of a job to really look at that. And there is the Water Resources Development Act of 2020 that Congress passed that really asks them to take into consideration how to implement more resilient ways of doing it that are nature-based and look at the flood risk reduction and water quality improvements while also looking at how it affects the natural ecosystem and also directing some of those resources towards disadvantaged and vulnerable communities. So there's a petition on my website, if you all could sign that. I mean, one thing I talk about all the time is how we just all have to do our part to improve our global situation, and climate change is really real. And I'm so thankful that we actually have an administration that is taking up climate change now. It's a refreshing reality. Not that it's something we all want to deal with, because it's going to sometimes make us a little uncomfortable looking at the ways that we overuse and overconsume. But we all need to do our part and do that for real. And the Biden administration hosted this past week a climate summit for world leaders in anticipation of the United Nations summit that's coming up in November in Glasgow. And, you know, he brought all these world leaders together to try to take a look at greenhouse gas emissions. Of course, we're a little late coming to the table ourselves, considering that the U.S. has been the largest emissions of greenhouse gases in the world. You know, now China has surpassed us, but we have certainly contributed to so much greenhouse gas emissions over the years. And there's countries that are really struggling, you know, and just coming up to or starting to really use the greenhouse gases and start emitting, and they take offense to having to be a part of trying to deal with the solution when they were not so much a part of creating the problem. But nevertheless, you know, he brought everybody together. You know, China is trying to tie their willingness to cut emissions to politics. You know, if we're willing to stay out of their foreign affairs, they're willing to take a look at climate change, which of course doesn't really work, because we do not want to stand by while, you know, abuses to human rights is being challenged. So it's very complicated, not easy. You know, then we have nations such as Australia, India, Indonesia, Mexico, and Russia, who made no pledges to cut their emissions. So a lot of work still has to happen. But in the meantime, I'm really happy that our country is finally taking a real look at it and coming up with ways to get us off of fossil fuels and to support wind and solar and other forms of energy, a big, big push towards electric cars. I mean, so many things. You know, if we had kept those solar panels that were on the White House back when Carter was president, we'd be a lot further along the road, but that didn't happen. So anyway, we all need to do our part. And as conscious individuals, you know, we need to look at our own personal global footprints, you know, in making good choices in the products we purchase, in the foods we eat, in the waste we discard, how much we recycle, how much we consume, and also our fossil fuel use. So every little bit helps. Just be aware of it and try to, you know, take little baby steps towards moving us in the right direction. And the New York Times put out a great guide for kids that is a perfect cheat sheet for all of us adults about the global footprint and crisis that we're in. So take a look at that. I have a link from my website as well. And so now I'd like to share my recipe with all of you so I can bring my guest on. This week and many, many times lately as I'm working full time, I come home and I need to put together a quick meal. I don't have the luxury of so much time. And so pasta is definitely, you know, at least a once a week meal for us now. And, you know, you can get really great organic pastas, whole wheat pastas, rice, brown rice pastas, you know, whatever pasta you like will work with this recipe. And as a vegan, you know, I am trying to eat a lot more beans as well as, you know, my tofu, my tempeh, and my seitan. So this recipe is a Tuscan pasta with white beans. And you're going to start with, the ingredients you need is a pound of pasta, your choice, a bunch of rainbow chard, a bunch of broccoli cut into bite-sized florets, two shallots peeled, sliced, and separated into ringlets, olive oil, a can of cannellini beans, drained. Of course, if you want to make fresh ones, go for it. But in my time reality, canned beans are wonderful. Just a little tip, I actually buy Eden brand beans, E-D-E-N. Eden brand is the only one I know of that actually cooks their beans with kombu. And kombu is a seaweed that makes the beans less gassy. So it's a wonderful little tip to know. Even if you're cooking your own, put a little piece of kombu in there and the beans will be less gassy. A bunch of sage chopped, a teaspoon of oregano, one onion chopped, 2 tablespoons plus 1 teaspoon of chopped garlic, 5 whole cloves of garlic, 2 cups of cherry tomatoes sliced in half, 1/3 cup of white wine, 1/4 cup of fresh Italian parsley, salt and pepper to taste, and red pepper flakes if you like your pasta sauce to be a little spicy, which we do. And just know that all these vegetables are interchangeable. If you don't have Swiss chard, it's not an excuse to not make this. You can put kale, you can just add more broccoli, you can just leave it out. All of my recipes are really flexible. So you're going to cook the pasta according to the directions, and I like to cook it al dente, which just means like a minute less than fully cooked. So it has a little bite to it, especially if you're going to put it in with the sauce and it's going to cook another minute in the sauce. Meanwhile, while the pasta water is boiling, you're going to cover a large wok or saute pan with olive oil. You're going to add the broccoli and the Swiss chard with 1 tablespoon of the chopped garlic and cook that for about 5 minutes. Then add the white wine and cook for another couple of minutes. Remove the greens from the wok and then add a little more oil to the bottom of the wok. Now add the onions and the whole garlic cloves. And when they're translucent, add the beans along with 1 tablespoon of chopped garlic and 1/2 of the chopped sage. Cook that for 3 more minutes. Remove the wok and add that to the greens. Add more. That doesn't make sense. Cook for 3 more minutes. Remove from wok. I guess it bring the add the Swiss chard back into the wok. Then you can add the cherry tomatoes to the wok and add 1 teaspoon of oregano and the salt and pepper and let that cook for a few more minutes until the cherry tomatoes start breaking down. Bring all the vegetables together, add the red pepper flakes if you'd like. And then in a small saucepan, I fried up the shallot rings just till they were crispy and remove them with a slotted spoon, put them on paper towel. And then after I made the whole pasta and put the sauce on top, I just sprinkled the fried shallots on top as a little crunch. And it was just really delicious. And you can also sprinkle a little extra sage on top there if you'd like. And that's it. It really comes together very quickly. It's delicious. And I hope you all enjoy it. And now it is my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest this week, Katie Martin. She's the executive director of the Food Share Institute for Hunger Research and Solutions. She has over 20 years of experience developing and evaluating creative solutions for hunger. In her new book, Reinventing Food Banks and Pantries, Katie focuses on the connection between hunger and health and identifying the root causes of food insecurity. Katie has a long track record of building collaborations with local and national anti-hunger organizations. She led the team performing the first rigorous evaluation of a food pantry program in Hartford, Connecticut. Katie used what she learned from that project and has collaborated with Food Share and Urban Alliance to create the More Than Food framework, which is a goal of the framework is to build capacity within food pantries to address the underlying causes of hunger. Several food pantries nationwide are replicating the framework. Katie also helped to develop a new stoplight nutrition system called SWAP, which stands for Supporting Wellness at Pantries, to promote healthy food in food banks and food pantries. And it has a whole scoring system, and we'll talk about that as we get into our conversation. Katie is recognized as a national leader on food security issues and has presented her research at dozens of regional and national conferences. She earned her BA in political science from Indiana University and an MS and PhD in nutritional science and policy from Tufts University. Welcome, Katie.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ah, my pleasure. Great book that you just wrote and such a needed book. I work very closely with a friend of mine who runs the River Fund Food Pantry. And I've been cooking for them for over 25 years during the holidays for Christmas and Thanksgiving. We feed over 1,000 people. But I remember when he changed to food choice, where people could actually come in and pick the foods they want. They didn't have to take that, 5-pound can ham if they didn't want it. They had a little more choice. And I think, that whole system that you developed is really, really great. But let's backtrack first. I always love starting my interviews asking my guests, how did you get involved with this? How did you come to work with food and food hunger and food pantries?
I love framing this from my circuitous path to get involved with nutrition work. As you mentioned, I have a bachelor's degree in political science, and you know, when I was an undergrad, I thought that I might want to work overseas, perhaps with the Peace Corps, doing development work. I knew I wanted to make a difference in the world. And I had a summer internship with my congressman from my hometown of Dayton, Ohio. And I spent the summer in Washington, D.C. And his name is Tony Hall. And he has been a lifelong advocate for anti-hunger work, both domestically and internationally. And so he really honed my interest on the issue of hunger specifically. And that's really what shaped the direction of my career and my education, and realizing that I didn't have to travel overseas to tackle the issue of hunger, that there's plenty of work that we need to do here at home. And then I spent a lot of time working with food banks and food pantries, visiting a lot of different food pantries around the country, and conducting research. And by that, I mean having a lot of conversations with individuals who struggle with food insecurity to understand some of their struggles and their challenges, but also their dreams and their hopes for their families. And that's helped shape a lot of the work that I do and the impetus for wanting to write this book.
Yeah. You know, so often, and I can never say it enough, you know, so many people think that those that receive SNAP or, you know, assistance, that they're lazy and that they just want a handout. And they don't realize that these families, most of them are working not just one job, but two jobs, three jobs. You know, they're working so hard. It's just the pay scale is so ridiculous that, you know, the low paying jobs that they qualify for is not enough to have a good quality life. And, you know, you're going to choose between paying your rent or buying food. And so these assistant programs are lifelines for so many people. And of course, raising a minimum wage is certainly going to help. Yeah. It's a great first step, but, you know, it's such a deeper problem.
Well, and I really hope that COVID has broaden our awareness of that, you know, of how many people were getting by okay with one, two, three different jobs working where they're making ends meet, but just barely, and how many people were living paycheck to paycheck. And then when you miss a paycheck or two, when your job is pulled out from under you, how many new people were food insecure?
Yeah.
And I talk so frequently about how it's not that we don't have enough food in the United States of America. It's that we have income inequality. We have systemic inequality, injustices that create the kind of environment where you can be working two or three jobs and not have health insurance, not have sick paid leave, and not have enough really to afford food for your family. And that's right. It's a social injustice.
Yeah. And then I also was reading, I don't think people think about grandma next door. You know, it's not just the immigrant population or the color population or, you know, whatever people, it's grandma and grandpa as well. I mean, seniors were hit so bad with all the food meal on wheel programs stopping and senior centers closing down. And I mean, it was just, I mean, horrendous, and it still continues to be. So your work is so important. I thought we could just start for some of my listeners who may not know the difference between a food bank and a food pantry. Maybe you could just share with them the distinction between those two, because that's really important.
It really is. And I talk about this early in my book, because even though there are food banks and food pantries in nearly every community around the country, and most people have been involved in one way, shape, or form with donating food, most people don't know the difference, and I think it's really important. So a food bank is a regional warehouse that often serves multiple counties, sometimes an entire state, and they collect millions of pounds of food, primarily from food manufacturers, the food industry, from grocery stores, and then they distribute that food to local food pantries, meal programs, mobile distribution sites that then distribute food directly to individuals. And one thing that I think it's important to know the difference, because often people are familiar with a local food pantry in their community that may be fairly small, run by volunteers, maybe open once or twice a month. And they feel like that is their image of what a food pantry is. And I like the adage that when you've seen one food pantry, you've seen one food pantry. And
that's great, right?
Right. And they look very different. And there are some that are very small, totally volunteer run. You have others that are more like small social service offices that are open multiple days a week with paid staff, et cetera. And then the food bank is at a much larger level with, you know, dozens of employees and boards of directors, et cetera. So understanding the scope of this helps to appreciate the impact that food banks and food pantries truly have on our food system. That when we think about where people get their food, I think we often overlook the important role that food pantries and food banks can play.
Mm-hmm. Right. And one of the problems with so many food banks is the food that they are, that people donate to them has to be shelf stable, right? It's very little fresh food is getting to the food banks. Although I think we're starting to change that, right?
We really are. And I think that's something that I think is important to know, that increasingly food banks for a while now have been receiving fresh produce. About 18 years ago, almost 20 years ago now, a food bank in Western Michigan came up with a creative solution. They were able to receive more fresh produce, but many of the food pantries in their network didn't have the kind of refrigeration. They weren't equipped to take fresh produce. So the food bank created a mobile program where they had refrigerated trucks that they would then drive to communities, to particularly areas with high need that may not have as many grocery stores, et cetera, to be able to provide fresh produce directly into the community. What's really great is over the last 20 years, we've been building the capacity of food pantries to be able to handle more fresh produce. So again, the old school mentality is kind of as you described, that this is, it's a food pantry with totally non-perishable food, cans of soup and beef stew. Whereas many, many food pantries now can look more like farmers markets. They can look more like a Trader Joe's, a beautiful grocery store, especially when they design it such as you described, where people have the choice to choose their own food like they would at a grocery store.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So can you describe your new vision of food banks and pantries as empowering community hubs where clients receive more than just food?
Sure. So I was involved with a really innovative program in Hartford, Connecticut, that was opened in 2010. It's called Fresh Place, and it is designed with client choice where people can choose their own food. And there is a case manager who works individually as a coach with individuals to identify what are the underlying root causes of why that family's having a hard time getting enough food. And it's also, you know, an empowering space to help people work on goals, to set goals so that they hopefully don't need to keep coming back to the food pantry line. We conducted research and found really significant differences from people who went to Fresh Place compared to other traditional food pantries that were really just providing short-term supplies of food. And we've been replicating that in other communities, and we know that it works. And so the vision is where you have an anchor organization, or what I refer to as a community food hub, where it's a very welcoming, dignified place where people don't feel embarrassed to go get food. And there's a lot of creative ways we can do that, making, you know, painting the colors a bright colors, having signage that is welcoming and empowering, and helping to connect individuals with other services within the community. And what that can look like is, it doesn't mean that the food pantry staff have to be experts on all of these issues, And it doesn't mean that they necessarily have to offer all of them on site, but we want to make sure that if someone's coming in and they're having a challenge paying their utility bills, if they've got a legal issue, if they need help with affordable childcare or working on job training, helping to connect them with additional existing resources within the community to help build their stability and their self-sufficiency. And we describe this as offering more than food. So again, changing the paradigm of what we think of food pantry as a place with only non-perishable food where people come to get 3 days worth of food for their families to a hub where you would go to be connected with all kinds of other services and hopefully where people could share their experiences with food insecurity, their challenges, and they can become advocates, not just for themselves, but also for their community.
That's great. The food pantry that I work with is much more like that, where they offer the other services and, you know, they bring pregnant women together and they have a community baby shower and make sure that every parent has a car seat and a, you know, all those, you know, a stroller of some sort. And, you know, yeah, we, you know, people knit blankets and yes, it's a really lovely place. They have a program that they call From Cradle to College. And, you know, they really support, they have a case manager, like you're saying, and they support the family from when the kids are born and then really help them filling out the forms to get those scholarships for college. But then also they give them supplemental money every month to support the child so that the child doesn't have to quit school to support the family, to help pay for the books. And, you know, I mean, they did a study, I think, like of the 30,000 underserved kids that get scholarships to college, I think like 1/10 might graduate, maybe even less, because of not being able to support their families and having to buy books. I mean, they drop out because of a few thousand dollars.
That's exactly right. And I love that. It's when you appreciate the other challenges that people are experiencing, that the food is just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah. Yeah.
And usually the food is kind of the easy solution that we can help with. But what we try to do is really, how do we tackle those underlying issues so that we can hopefully stop the cycle of poverty and food insecurity?
Exactly. That's what they keep talking about, to break that cycle and getting these youngsters into college and a good education is what's going to break that cycle. Also in your book, you write about that food insecurity is a matter of access and power, not a lack of food. Can you talk about what you mean by that?
Yeah. It's not really rocket science. And I would imagine that for most of your listeners, this is going to be, you know, just of course.
Right.
But unfortunately, when we think about hunger in the United States, very often the way that we think about the problem is that it's a lack of food. And I think it's really important the way we define a problem defines our solution to that problem. So if we think about, okay, hunger is because there isn't enough food, well, then we need to collect and distribute more food to more people every year. And we've done a really, really good job of that. Yet we haven't solved the problem. So if on the other hand, just as we were talking at the beginning of the show, of if we define the problem of hunger in America as rooted in income inequality, lack of affordable jobs, housing, childcare, then our solutions become much more complex and they become more holistic. People are not food insecure in the United States because there isn't enough food. It's that they cannot afford and access food in their communities for their families. And there's just so many ways that we can tackle that. But it means that we have to enter into the political debate. We have to be able to talk about poverty, which is uncomfortable for a lot of folks. It's easier to think of poverty so messy and so complicated. Wouldn't it just be easier and safer to just talk about food and think about distributing food? So this is, I think, thankfully, more food banks are becoming more progressive and thinking about how we do a good job of distributing food, but if we really want to get serious about stopping the cycle, we need to talk about these other more complex root causes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember, I don't know how long ago, but, you know, it used to be, you know, the government would take the responsibility of feeding people in their country if they, you know, and they've kind of passed it on to volunteers and churches and, you know, and they're not really taking up the issue. And as the need became greater, more and more churches and volunteers stepped up to the plate. And so the government got less and less involved in dealing with this problem. Can you talk about that a little bit? That's just personally a frustration of mine.
Absolutely. And I think it's really important because there's a generation of individuals that have never known a time when there weren't food banks and food pantries in this country. And they may not realize, oh, it wasn't that long ago that this was considered the government's responsibility. My colleague, Jan Papendyk.
I know Jan.
She's just terrific. And she was very influential in my thinking of this work. She wrote a fantastic book called Sweet Charity that is about 20 years old, and it's still so relevant and so poignant today. And she really highlighted that issue of how in up until the 1970s, it absolutely was considered the government's responsibility. This is how we set a minimum wage, which is such a misnomer now, that the minimum should be the floor by which you can work a job and be able to, you know, make ends meet for your family. That has really eroded. And during the 1980s, there were some drastic cuts to federal food assistance programs, primarily the food stamp program, which is now called SNAP. And many people were then newly having trouble getting enough food for their family. That was kind of some food banks and pantries existed in the 1970s, but it was really in the 1980s that shifted. And that mentality of getting involved in your local community to volunteer, to be the 1,000 points of light, it shifted the notion of who's responsible for providing that safety net for people in need. The United Nations has a, you know, very clear statement of the right to food, that this is just a basic human right. The United States, unfortunately, does not view food as a basic human right. That is something that we should secure and guarantee. And when we shift the mentality to a volunteer, charitable emphasis, it really shifts the dynamic of how we solve this problem.
Right, right. And that's exactly what happened. So, let's talk a little bit about one of the silver linings of COVID. You touched on it at the beginning, but how do you think that played a role in raising awareness about food insecurity?
Yeah, I was very thick into writing my book when the pandemic hit. And I'm really, really grateful that I was still writing the book when I could incorporate some of those early lessons from COVID. So, you know, I think it became very clear and very visible for folks to appreciate how people who work at their favorite restaurant all of a sudden were out of a job. People who work at their daycare center are out of a job. And food banks responded very quickly by providing more drive-through distributions to be able to meet the need quickly. And we in the food banking world there was a lot of press and a lot of publicity on these massive food distribution lines. So I think a lot of people in your own personal life, you could appreciate people you probably knew in your neighborhood and people that you would visit that have recently lost their job and might
be. I lost mine.
Right.
The school lunch program just overnight. You know, just one day we were there. The next day it was like, school's closed. And I'm like, well, this can't be for long. I mean, who would ever have thought that the whole country would close down school, right? And so then they, you know, at first I started working with them. They set up an immediate food pantry to try to help some of the families in the community, and I helped with that for a bit, you know, but then they were just bagging lunch, and I was like, well, let's get fresh vegetables and bag lunch. And they're like, well, we have to use up all the food that's in all the freezers of all the schools. So so they went into that kind of, you know, emergency mode, and there was no room for thinking about putting fresh vegetables into the brown paper bag. So
I know. Yeah. I think that COVID has definitely hurt all of us on a personal level and professional levels. It just is, you know, this has been an incredible year. I'm hopeful that the new awareness about food insecurity, and it's easier to connect the dots with those root causes of, you know, that was no fault of your own. You weren't right. Late, not doing your job, right? Your job was taken away. That I'm hopeful that people will have a better appreciation for longer term solutions to the problem now.
Mm-hmm. I hope so. So what does the pandemic reveal about the role of food banks and pantries in America? I guess we've touched on that a bit already, but maybe you want to just highlight that a little more.
Yeah, you know, I think COVID in many ways, it exposed how our system was already broken in a lot of ways. Our economic system in the United States with income inequality was broken, but even within food banks, so on a really local level, but I would imagine many other food banks around the country experience this also. We work in Greater Hartford, Connecticut, not far from you. And on paper, it looks like we have a lot of food pantries that serve the high need and high rates of poverty in the city of Hartford. There are about 60 food pantries in the city, in a small city like Hartford. So on the surface, that sounds great, and it feels like we're responding to the need. But what COVID exposed was that many of those food pantries were all volunteer run, typically with folks who are retired, senior citizens who are giving back in their community. And so they weren't able to be involved with the food pantry for their own public health concerns. And many of those food pantries were open maybe one time a month, very limited hours. So when we think about food access, when we think about ensuring that people have a place to go to get adequate food, you know, it really exposed, maybe this network of food pantries is not as robust, is not as comprehensive as we thought it might be. And so it helps us to think of how do we get into move along the path to that community food hub model, where we probably have fewer food pantries that are open multiple days a week with paid staff, paid livable wages, where we can provide more wraparound services. That when we rely on all volunteers and all charity, it probably isn't as strong as we'd like it to be.
Mm-hmm. And in your book, you also talk about trauma-informed care. Mm-hmm. How does that have to do with food banks and food pantries?
Right. It's still a fairly new concept for food banks and food pantries. I think within social service settings, it's a little bit of a buzzword, but understanding how people may have experienced trauma is really important when we're working with people who are struggling with food insecurity and poverty, because if we're not careful, we can trigger additional trauma or reinforce some of the trauma that they've experienced. That's important in the way that we design our programs and the way that we provide our services. So if you have an appreciation for, you know, when someone's experienced trauma, it can help you think differently about the people that we serve and the way we do our work. And there are trainings, they're really nice trainings that can give you an appreciation of what trauma means. And if you think about the way we measure food insecurity, kind of the definition of food insecurity is when people say they worry about having enough food before their money will run. They worry about having enough food at the end of the week, at the end of the month. That's traumatic. And also, if you've experienced some kind of trauma, whether that's physical abuse, mental abuse, some type of violence, it's going to be harder for you to hold a job. It's going to be harder for you to, you know, stay in school, which is going to also contribute to being more food insecure. So if we set up our programs in a way where people have to line up really close to one another and wait a long time in line for food, that can be triggering. That can reinforce the stress, the anxiety, the concern about getting enough food. We don't mean harm by that, but we can cause harm. So having an appreciation for the impact of trauma can help us, you know, again, thinking about how do we design our food pantries where people can choose their own food, having that dignity, the empowerment of, you know what, you have autonomy to choose your own food rather than being handed food from a volunteer. How do we design our spaces so that it's more welcoming and empowering and that it won't reinforce trauma?
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I had a guest on Melissa Nelson a few weeks ago, you know, Indigenous activist and educator and scholar. And she was talking about, you know, soul wound, race, historical trauma, you know, racism trauma, you know, I mean, people of color, Indigenous communities, they've been dealing with trauma. I mean, you know, I think of it as a mother. I mean, you know, if every time my son left the house, I was worried for their safety. I mean, that's lifelong trauma. That's trauma every single day. Right. You know, I mean, you don't realize as a, you know, for me as a white person, the privilege I have just by that I'm not even aware of because I'm white, you know, people of color, Indigenous people, Hispanic people who are afraid of being pulled over if they don't have the right papers. I mean, just living with that kind of fear and trauma on a day-to-day basis wears you down and
absolutely
has to affect you.
Absolutely. And then how that, I mean, there's so many ways that that matters, but one of the things I talk about a fair amount in the book is the role of volunteers. So if your volunteers at a food pantry are all white and they probably mean well, but can we reinforce some of that trauma and that division and the power dynamic between the haves, the have-nots, the givers versus the receivers? We can perpetuate that white privilege, and we can perpetuate that vision of feeling less than, versus if we design our programs in ways where we break down the barriers, we break down the walls physically and emotionally between the giver and the receiver. There's so many different ways that we can do that to celebrate and appreciate the folks that we serve, as opposed to reinforcing that type of privilege.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but so, you know, how do you get around it? I mean, if the people of color and Indigenous people who are working those low-end jobs, they don't have the time to volunteer. They're busy supporting themselves. So, you know, how do you change that up?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, part of it is just the way you design the program so that it's not just white volunteers who are handing out food to all minority population. You know, there are a lot of subtle ways that you can design the programs and engage people or hire them to work at the food pantry so that it is a meaningful job and a paid job and not just volunteer run as well.
Right. That would be awesome. Right. So I know you shared one example, the Fresh Place in Hartford, Connecticut, but does any other program that you work with really stand out, you know, of how they're dealing with some of these creative problem solving issues?
Yeah. So there are many, and that's one of the things that I try to do in the book is to really highlight so many of the innovative things that are happening to provide inspiration so that others can think of what's possible. There's a food pantry in Peacedale, Rhode Island. It's called the Johnny Cake Center, and they have a thrift store. They have a food pantry. They have spaces for classes and workshops. They have a leadership board where they're engaging people within the community to share their experiences and their voices to help co-design programs and services. That's a great example. In my book, I highlight an innovative program in El Paso, Texas, that's called the Kelly Center for Hunger Relief. They also provide classes and workshops. They have Zumba classes on site and other ways to empower folks. There's a wonderful program in Greater Chicago called Beyond Hunger. And they do a lot of nutrition education and wraparound services to really promote healthy, nutritious food and wellness within their food pantry. I mean, I could go on and on. There are many. I think it's about imagination. And it's why, you know, my book, I talk about reinventing. It's a matter of like being creative and imaginative and listening to the needs of the people we serve to understand what would they like this to look like? What kind of resources and services do they need? So you're a great example of, you know, working with young moms and families. How do we support families in the community? There are a lot of wonderful examples like this.
Mm-hmm. Can you share with my listeners the program you developed called SWAP and what that stands for? Because I thought that, you know, when looking at your book, I thought that really, stood out. I mean, it made me think of, you know, back when my kids were little, you know, Cookie Monster was the rage and it was like cookies all the time, you know, and then someone should share with me that, you know, Cookie Monster now has, you know, sometime foods, all the time foods and never foods. Right. And your program kind of made me think of that. Can you share with us the SWAP program?
Yeah. So it evolved from I would spend a lot of time in food pantry settings and encouraging food pantry staff and directors to promote healthy food, more produce, more nutritious food. And then I realized, well, wait a minute. Most of us don't have clear ideas of what do we mean by healthy food? And so I wanted to create a really simple and intuitive system that staff and volunteers who may not have any nutrition background could use to identify which foods should you choose often, choose sometimes, choose rarely. And that's how SWAP came about. And it stands for Supporting Wellness at Pantries. And the emphasis here was really at the food pantry level. How could we create a system? It's a stoplight. And I use that because if English isn't your first language, or if you have low literacy skills, it's fairly intuitive to know that what a stoplight means. But in this instance, the red doesn't mean no, it doesn't mean stop. It means think of these items as a treat. We all like treats sometimes. And SWAP is based on three nutrients, saturated fat, sodium, and added sugars, because these are most directly linked with chronic diseases. And we know that folks who are food insecure and visiting food pantries are at disproportionately high rates of these chronic diseases. The exciting thing is that SWAP is now being used by food banks around the country and other food pantries. And it's really seen as a national model for being able to increase both the supply and the demand for healthy food.
It's great. It's great. And it's, when you talk about nutrition, it's amazing that how little people really do know, even with how much is in the news. And our government has actually helped to perpetuate that. They almost want to keep us confused so that... Because with all the pressure from the lobbyists, I mean, I remember, you know, when I first was getting into this and, you know, back in the 1970s, I think it was McGovern had said, you know, we need to recommend that people cut down on meat. And the pushback from the meat lobbyists was like, no way, you cannot say that as a guide to healthy eating. Mm-hmm. And so instead they said, you know, choose lean meat. Well, no one knew what that meant. You know, I mean, there's no direction. What does lean meat mean? And so it really changed nothing. And so the power of our lobby system has so much power. And they purposely, I think, try to keep people confused so that, you know, people still buy it. I mean, like the minute, you know, something's low fat is supposed to be good, they now put low fat on everything, but they up the sugar to give it the flavor from taking out the fat. And so,
yeah,
people, you know, they just, and they keep people confused.
Absolutely. Marion Nessel has written so much about this in food politics. But it's also the food industry that, you know, is profiting on our poor health. And it's, they are very creative at making our food so addictive. And this is one of my hopes with SWAP, is that it's nutrition education for families who are shopping in the food pantry. But it's also really important thinking upstream, that when we use SWAP at a food pantry, at a food bank sponsored by Feeding America, we then can use our collective impact to encourage the food donors. If we select less red food, the food industry will make less red food. They will change the amounts of saturated fat, sodium, and sugar that we put in our products if we encourage that and we demand healthier food. So that's one of the things that excites me, is thinking from the supply side of how might we influence the food industry to make healthier food, because we're just not as interested in it because we're more aware.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The bad side is that I was talking about this a few weeks ago, I forget which guest, just how, these food companies are now buying up the healthy companies. You go into a supermarket and you think you have all this choice, but the reality is there's five major food companies that own all these other food companies. So you think you have all this choice, when in actuality, very often we don't. And I was also, from Michael Moss's new book, Hooked, he talks about how these food corporations have also invested now in the diet market. Like they've bought up Weight Watchers and Jenny Craig and all these diet companies so that they can make money on, first they get us addicted on the fattening, unhealthy foods, and then they want to make profit on our attempts at trying to get thin. It's just so, so horrible.
We've got an uphill battle, don't we?
We do. We do. So you acknowledge that many food banks and pantries rely on shoestring budgets and volunteer staffs. What does that mean for their ability to implement solutions that you describe in the book when they have so little money to really, like the idea of hiring, creating a position and hiring some people of color so that they can work at the food pantry and have a good job? What's the reality of that?
Right. One of the things that I highlight early in the book is the idea of scarcity mentality. And we can think about this for the people, when people are struggling with poverty and food insecurity, you're focused on lack. You worry about having enough food at the end of the week, at the end of the month. How are you going to balance paying rent, paying bills? That makes sense, that focus on lack at the individual level. But the other thing that I highlight, and it's been interesting, a lot of people have been commenting about this important emphasis on scarcity mentality at the organizational level. So as nonprofits, we often feel like we don't have enough space, we don't have enough volunteers, we don't have enough money, we don't have enough food, we don't have enough, we don't have enough. That limits our ability to think creatively and think more holistically about the work that we do. So for example, if you're going to use the SWAP stoplight system, it will take more volunteer time and take more effort to rank your food nutritionally. But I would argue it opens the door for new funding sources so that you can engage with other funders that are interested in not just reducing food insecurity, but reducing health disparities. It opens the door for new collaborations, for new partnerships, and new funding sources. So it's a matter of really letting go of our ego and finding out who else can we collaborate with within our communities. We probably can't do this all on our own. And if we stay stuck and this is how we have to just do it, I'm just focused on lack, we're going to be more likely to just keep promoting, just handing out food. But when we look at who else could we partner with, what other volunteers might we engage if we offer these other kinds of services, who else can we partner with? We're going to be better able to do more holistic work and have bigger budgets to do it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Then you need good grant writers. We've talked about how food pantries have evolved over, the decades, addressing hunger and, and bringing in these other resources, which, just seems to make so much sense. Can you share with us some of the measurable outcomes that you've seen from some of these differences of how people are reinventing the food pantries?
Sure. So through our Institute for Hunger Research and Solutions, research is part of that. You know, I am, and it's really why I chose to get my PhD was so that I could quantify and have evidence to show, you know, are there better ways to tackle this? Otherwise, you know, kind of broad issue of hunger. So we've conducted a lot of rigorous research, starting at Fresh Place, and then continuing to evaluate food pantries that offer more than food, where people meet with a coach over time. We see really statistically significant differences in their food security, in their self-sufficiency, their self-efficacy, and their diet quality compared to people who go to other traditional food pantries where they're not offering those wraparound services. We've also conducted some really nice research with the SWAP system. So when food pantries offer SWAP, their guests select more green and yellow food and they select less red food. When food banks use the SWAP system, their food pantries order more green and yellow food and less red food. So there's a fair amount of research that goes into this. There's so much more research that's needed. I'm encouraged by more academics who are getting involved in food security research, because we really need you. I think it's an under-evaluated field of work.
Mm-hmm. And we're almost out of time. Can you share with people how they find out more about the institute that you're working with?
Sure. You could go to foodshare.org/institute, and we've got information there. You can go, my email is kmartin@foodshare.org if you want to learn more about the work that we do. On our Institute page, you can subscribe for free and you can get monthly updates where we provide research briefs and articles and information. And then we also host monthly webinars where we talk about specific issues. Our webinar in May is going to be specifically on client choice and the value of offering choice within food pantry settings.
Wonderful. And they can buy your book, Reinventing Food Banks and Pantries. And for everyone listening, I will share on my website the links to the Food Share Institute and also Kate's email and the book link. So if you want to learn more about food pantries and how you can get involved, that would be really great. So Kate, thank you so much for taking the time joining me.
Thank you for having me. What a pleasure. I hope you have a great day.
Thank you. Everyone out there who's been listening, thank you for joining us. Have a great rest of the day and I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.